This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. The movement to pardon the Groveland Four has gained momentum in recent weeks. Author Gilbert King wrote about the miscarriage of justice in that case in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book Devil in the Grove. In his next book, Beneath a Ruthless Sun, King returned to Lake County to investigate another story of racism and injustice. We're going to revisit a conversation with King about that book. Gilbert King, welcome to Intersection.
Ah, great to be here, thanks.
Your first book, Devil in the Grove, focused on a Lake County case too, and Sheriff Willis V. McCall was a key figure in that case as well. You're returning to familiar ground here. Why decide to come back and tackle another story in Lake County?
You know, it wasn't something that I really wanted to do. I was doing a book talk in 2012 in Groveland in Lake County, and a deputy came up to me, and I was signing books, and he kind of stuck his business card like right in my face. And it's all I could read was Sheriff of Lake County. And it was kind of intimidating. And I kind of stepped back and I saw that his name was Evie Griffin. And I'd recognize him because he was in my book and he did something kind of unusual. He actually turned in two fellow deputies for falsifying evidence against two African-Americans. And these African-Americans were just days away from the electric chair. And by turning him in, he got a stay of execution and the FBI did an investigation and he saved their lives. And he said to me later on, he said, you know, you got your book right, but you didn't get the whole story. There's another story down here. And he went on to tell me the story of Jesse Daniels and how his department had framed this kid. And he said it just haunted him for decades.
Mm-hmm. Set the story up for listeners who may not have had the opportunity to read Beneath a Ruthless Sun.
So it's basically the story of 1957 in the wake of Brown versus Board. Racial tensions are very high, especially in Florida, because there was a recent election that was all about race. And on the night of December 17th, 1957, a wealthy white wife of a citrus baron is actually sexually assaulted in her home while her three young children are in the home. Her husband is away, allegedly on a business trip. And she reports to the police that she's been sexually assaulted by an African-American, and the police do what they usually do, Sheriff McCall. They round up two dozen suspects, throw them in cars, and start interrogating them. And basically, they settle on this one suspect who's the nephew of the civil rights man in Okahumka, Florida, who's trying to integrate the University of Florida College of Law. And so they parade him out as this, they got the suspect, the evidence is conclusive. And then something really strange happens in the case. The next night, some of the wealthier and more powerful people in Lake County get together and they have a little talk with the sheriff. And they basically say, Blanche Bosanquet Knowles, the victim in this case, it won't do that she was sexually assaulted by an African-American. We need to find a white suspect. And so they release Virgil Hawkins' nephew, and they find a white mentally disabled teenager by the name of Jesse Daniels, and they frame him and railroad him for this crime.
Mm-hmm. There are several heroes in the story. I mean, the deputy you mentioned right at the start, Evie Griffin, is one of them, but a couple of people really stand out, especially for a journalist reading this book. Mabel Norris Reese, she followed Willis V. McCall. She reported on what he was up to. And she followed this story particularly. Describe her for listeners, and what is it that makes her such a compelling part of the story?
Well, here's what I really love about Mabel Norris Reese, because I had written about her in Devil in the Grove. And if you remember in the early part of Devil in the Grove, she's basically all on board with Willis McCall and all his policies. In fact, after the Groveland incident, she's calling for the execution of the Groveland boys. And so she sort of participates in this community involvement for swift justice and executions. But then when Willis McCall shoots the two Groveland boys on the side of the road after the Supreme Court has overturned their trial, Mabel kind of has an awakening. And from that point on, she decides that she's going to stay on top of Willis McCall and report on all his civil rights violations. And there were, you know, dozens of them. He was constantly being investigated. And she just stayed on top of him, and that did not go over too well in her community. She had a little newspaper, a weekly newspaper, and in the middle of her reporting, she had a cross burn in her yard. She had her house was bombed. Her dog was poisoned to death. Her newspaper office was vandalized, and then the final straw was the Klan basically came in and set up a rival newspaper and warned all of Mabel's advertisers that she could not operate in this county anymore, and they drove her out of the county. So I thought, like, what she was up against, trying to just report journalism and report the facts on what were happening in Lake County under this tyrant sheriff, it basically got her kicked out of the county. But she just never stopped reporting on it, and she went to another town 50 miles away and still wrote about Willis McCall.
Did she have a lot of influence in that community?
You know, I would say that really no. I don't think she had as much influence, but in the community, she was sort of seen as a pariah. And because Willis McCall was always gaslighting her and saying, you can't believe her, she's a communist. Red Mabel, that's what he called her. You know, just constantly saying she's just cussing me out for being a white man. And she would really be, you know, gaslighted by McCall and his tactics. But once she got outside of Lake County, she worked for a bigger newspaper and she picked up more readership. And that began to attract the attention of political people around the state. And that was really what really helped her.
The cross-burning, the dog poisoning, the intimidation tactics, was there a connection, or what was the connection between what was going on there and the sheriff's office?
Well, I mean, that's what's really interesting. Back then in the 40s and 50s especially, the lines between law enforcement and Klan were really blurred. In fact, I write about one of the deputies in here who admitted to me that he was not only a deputy, but he was also in the Klan. And he really described very accurately how the law enforcement in Lake County worked with the Klan. And it was basically an agreement like the Klan would let law enforcement take care of these issues. But if they weren't really handled right or they were too messy, the Klan would take care of them on the outside. Mm-hmm. And he described incidents where that was done violently. So Willis McCall really was subtle about being in the Klan. There were other sheriffs who were more open about being in the Klan and leading their parades. McCall wasn't really open about it, but all the informants that the FBI had in this community identified him at countless meetings as giving orders. So everybody knew that he was involved. And that's one of the most disturbing parts of this. I mean, it was pretty obvious that there was not going to be any local enforcement of this. You know, I like to look at Willis McCall as this powerful sheriff, but, you know, somebody like him would not have been possible unless judges, state attorneys, U.S. attorneys, and governors themselves didn't have his back. And they did at every level over decades. He had so much power over them that he could actually destroy their own election chances by just releasing information about corruption. And also there was really no advantage to, you know, coming down hard on white supremacy in these small southern counties. And so Willis McCall liked to brag that he beat 49 investigations on civil rights charges. And it was true. Mm-hmm. None of those charges ever stuck. And so he was able to get away with everything that he did.
I was doing a bit of reading as I was reading Beneath the Ruthless Sun, and I note that Willis McCall actually wrote some kind of autobiography at some point.
Yeah, and that's a hard book to get a hold of. I think there's a couple of them on eBay selling for about $800. But I managed to get a copy from the University of Florida. And, you know, I think part of it is sometimes people give me a little grief for, like, publishing these quotes that Willis McCall had put out there and, you know, finding them, these selective quotes. A lot of these quotes were in his autobiography. So he stood by these quotes. Hmm. He printed these quotes in his own book. And so if you're going to give me grief for mentioning some of these quotes that Willis McCall said in the 1950s, just recall that Willis McCall wrote this autobiography in the late 80s, early 90s, and he was standing by these quotes. Mm-hmm. And some of them are some of the most racist things I've ever heard, actually.
Who are you getting grief from for reporting on this or for putting these quotes in your book?
It's not a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, for the overwhelming majority recognize Sheriff McCall for what he is. But every once in a while, I'll get like a Facebook message or an email or something saying, you know, you're really presenting a one-sided picture of Willis McCall. And, you know, my response is always like, let's see the other side. I mean, I'd be happy to hear it. Somebody told me he really liked horses. And I started looking into it, and then I asked Evie Griffin. He said he didn't like that horse. He punched that horse several times during the parade.
What, this was a sheriff's office horse?
Yeah. So I'm like, I couldn't even get the horse thing to be, you know, verified that he loved horses. So I'm sure he loved his children and he loved his family. But, you know, mainly I'm writing about his actions, and a lot of his actions involve murder.
So what kind of response has there been from folks in Lake County? Is this uncomfortable history to delve into and talk about?
I think it's uncomfortable for people who are close to it and grew up around it. I think some people have had their sort of visions, these utopic visions of their childhood in Leesburg, and you know, the beautiful orange groves and the sunshine. And when they learn that there's this very dark side lurking below the surface, it's kind of upsetting to their vision of what they grew up in, especially when they know that many of the people were friends of the family, that they were involved in this particular case.
But are a lot of these events like brand new information to them? Was it stuff they knew about but just maybe brushed aside?
I'm surprised that they've heard rumors about it, but they really had no information. In fact, I've talked to several family members who were involved in this, you know, whose families were involved in this case, and they weren't even sure of what really happened. Then. It was just something that nobody ever talked about.
We're talking to Gilbert King, author of Beneath a Ruthless Sun. He's also written, of course, Devil in the Grove. This is his second look at what was going on in Lake County in the 50s. Jesse Daniels, the young man who was, as you say, railroaded for this crime, he was sent to Florida State Hospital in Chattahoochee, the state mental institution. Describe that place. What was that like?
Well, I mean, this place was worse than a state prison, and particularly why? Because they had an overload of patients after World War II, I think the number of doctors to patients was like one doctor to every 1,000 patients. So you would go years sometimes without seeing a doctor. So it wasn't like you were being rehabilitated there. They were throwing them in these dorms and just warehousing them there. Some of them were getting lobotomies. Some of them were getting shock therapy. A lot of them were just getting, you know, doped with Thorazine so that they were just sitting around drooling in a stupor because they were easier to manage that way for hospital staff. Some of the most violent criminals in Florida were being sent to Chattahoochee to be evaluated psychologically. So Jesse Daniels, because he had this rape charge hanging over his head, he was put in with the most violent criminals. And for me to understand that, I went through all the records and looked at it. And Jesse Daniels said something to me once when I was interviewing him. He said, you know, I lost my childhood years at Chattahoochee. And I remember thinking, well, you were 19 when you went there. But also, doctors said he had the mind of a 10-year-old child. Mm. So it was like putting a 10-year-old in with these violent criminals in these horrible wards where the supervision was really lacking. And so he was really in a hellhole. It was a lockdown. There were all sorts of violent assaults. The guards were violent. It was not a place to be. And it was definitely not a place where they were taking care of mentally disabled people.
You mentioned some of the treatments on offer for mental institution patients back in the 50s, lobotomies, the kind of drugs they were using, the shock therapy. I mean, some of these details are pretty horrifying. It's kind of a detail in this story, but the insight into what was going on with mental health treatment in that era is stunning. And you have a story about something called the lobotomobile. It is a terrifying story.
It really is. It's like something from some Southern Gothic noir. This guy drives around from mental institute to mental institute with his lobotomy tools in this car. And, you know, one of the things I think was the most disturbing thing was they recognized that demand was increasing and they were not able to do as many lobotomies. So they had to find a quicker way to do it. And so instead of doing a surgical procedure, they did these ice pick lobotomies where they just electroshock the patient to make them numb. And then they would just take this ice pick and grind it underneath the eyelid and just sort of sever certain brain material. And that was passing for some kind of medical treatment. And this was happening a lot. It speeded up the process of the lobotomies. And it was just leaving, you know, thousands of patients in the wake. They were just the mental equivalent of a 4-year-old. They were no longer able to dress. They had to have help going to the bathroom. It really did nothing.
How did Jesse Daniels survive?
You know, that's a great question. I'm not really sure how he survived. I'm not, you know, some of the medical records I looked, they don't really list the things that happened to him. I think it wasn't in their best interest to document. But there was clearly, he was clearly abused in there. I've talked to his, the person who handles him is a reverend at a church in Daytona Beach. And I talked to him, and he pretty much insinuated that, you know, Jesse had a rough time in there and that he didn't like to talk about the things that happened to him in there. How he survived, I'm not really sure. The only thing I can say that he was extraordinarily docile, and he was extraordinarily non-confrontational. So I think he was just probably too easy a mark in a place like that. He didn't need to be hurt or restrained or anything like that. He just did as he was told, and that probably helped him.
Mm-hmm. And he made friends there.
Yeah, when it, you know, he sort of spent 14 years there. And so I think there were a lot of people that really, you know, sort of looked at him as almost like a mascot. They knew he didn't belong there. They knew he didn't have a violent bone in his body. And I think they were pulling for him, and especially some of the staff. Towards the end, when they replaced the staff and tried to modernize it, these new doctors, like, he's got to get out of here. This guy should not be in here at all.
What about Pearl Daniels then? Because she was dogged and trying to pursue justice for her son.
Yeah, I really love the story of Pearl Daniels because she becomes friends with Mabel. Pearl has no resources whatsoever. She has no education. She works in the watermelon patches of Lake County. And, you know, her husband is a disabled World War I vet who's unable to work. So she's out there working for the family. And, you know, she can't afford to hire a lawyer to represent Jesse. And so she's basically poking around Lake County trying to solve the case on her own. And she uses the only thing she really has, which is her voice. She writes letters to the governor constantly. And he starts writing her back eventually. And then she starts writing to J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI. And after like a dozen or so letters, Hoover begins to write back to her. And
this is one of the most incredible details in the book.
It really is. I couldn't been more surprised to see Hoover writing letters back to this poor watermelon picker in Lake County. And he's giving her legal advice. He says, you know, once this case goes to trial, you'll be able to get a lawyer appointed by the court. And she's like, no, you don't understand. Everybody is in on this. They're all in on this conspiracy to put my son away. And she just keeps hammering and hammering. And finally, I think she becomes such a nuisance to Hoover that Hoover just says, fine, open up a civil rights investigation and pushes it over to the DOJ. And that's actually what really started the whole process for Jesse, which started to see some daylight.
Mm-hmm. She did eventually get an attorney who was as concerned for Jesse's well-being as she was, Richard Graham. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he was a really interesting guy because he's just out of college. He goes to work ideally for this legal aid society in Daytona Beach, and he doesn't have much experience. And all of a sudden, Pearl walks in and starts to tell him about Jesse's case. And his first instinct is like, this is just some mother. I don't believe a word of this case. It sounds ridiculous. Like they're trying to frame him and this and that. And, you know, he couldn't really believe it. But eventually, he just recognized the sincerity in Pearl's eyes and in her voice, and he picked up the phone and called someone he knew in Lake County, Jesse's old lawyer. And that old lawyer told him that Jesse was definitely being railroaded, that he was totally innocent. And then he just begins to look into it, and I think it was because he had had a little more credentials than Jesse's other lawyers. He filed a habeas corpus with the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court, a few months later, sent a letter back to the Florida Supreme Court demanding that they show cause as to why they're holding Jesse Daniels. And that was a shocking development because so far Lake County had been able to keep this case under wraps. And now it was being looked at by the U.S. Supreme Court. And so, you know, Richard Graham, by just being aggressive and just taking it to the highest court in the land, was able to really get this case off the ground.
Mm-hmm. Your book is subtitled A True Story of Violence, Race, and Justice Lost and Found. So what did justice look like for Jesse Daniels when it finally arrived?
Well, I mean, I would agree that maybe the justice that he's found is not the most satisfying justice. But one of the interesting things is they filed a claims bill to compensate Jesse after a 3-year investigation. The 3-year investigation exonerated him 100% and said that he was entitled to compensation from the state for wrongful incarceration. And what's interesting is Richard Graham asked for only $122,000, but once all the evidence was looked at, the special master in the legislature doubled that. And so he was absolutely convinced that Jesse Daniels was innocent, and he pointed to a much larger conspiracy, and ultimately the U.S. attorneys came in and called a grand jury to look into this case to see if they could indict the men responsible. You know, what's interesting is that ultimately they cut Jesse's compensation down to $75,000, which really didn't go a long way in 1972. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that his only justice was that he had a newspaper reporter in Mabel Norris Reese that never stopped fighting for him. And when, you know, the legislature made the language of this claims bill and exonerate him, they said, were it not for an unfailing newspaper woman who never gave up on him, Jesse Daniels would have spent the rest of his life at Chattahoochee. And that was probably true.
What about Blanche Knowles then?
Well, Blanche does something very interesting towards the end. I mean, one of the things that Richard Graham was gambling on he never called Blanche as a witness because he was under the impression that Blanche refused to perjure herself, and she refused to go along with this conspiracy to send Jesse Daniels away. And so he took a gambit by not calling her as a witness, and ultimately it paid off because the state attorney, Gordon Oldham, dropped the case in 1970. And so by dropping the case, that moved the case into the legislature to determine his guilt. And Blanche did something interesting. Later on, she actually went back to school and got her master's degree in special education. And she went back to the school where Jesse would have gone to and worked with disabled kids for the rest of her career. So I just thought there was something about that that sort of spoke to her state of mind at the time.
What do you think makes this story particularly relevant today?
I think the thing that makes this really relevant is one of the things I think is that, you know, we went through an election in 2016 where all of this reporting was just sort of gaslighted by a president who said fake news. And this reminded me exactly what Mabel was experiencing in Lake County as she was trying to report on this. You know, standing up to someone powerful and just being told that you're wrong, you're making things up, everything you write is a lie. And I just, to me, it speaks to the power of journalism. I mean, she never quit, and she was unwavering in her commitment to the truth. And she had no doubt that ultimately the truth would catch up to Willis McCall. And I think that's what it tells me about the power of journalism. I also think it talks to me about how unresolved a lot of our racial issues are here in America. Talking about people being framed, this happens today. I mean, we have people who are exonerated by DNA evidence, which conclusively shows that somebody else committed this crime, and yet these people have confessed under interrogation to law enforcement. So that to me is just absolutely striking, that the way where our justice system works, where it's not so difficult even in 2018 to frame somebody on for a crime that they did not commit. And so I just think it's important to be aware of these things and to understand how law enforcement has worked over the decades and to make it relevant today.
Do you feel like Lake County has come to terms with what happened in the 1950s with this case, with Devil in the Grove, with Sheriff Willis McCall, and can it move on, or has it moved on?
Yeah, I'm not really sure how much it's come to terms with it. I think there's still an attitude where we just rather not know about this stuff. So if you go to Groveland and you look for markers where maybe some of these atrocities happened, or into the museums in Lake County where they talk about their proud history, and there's really nothing regarding some of these cases. And you know, this is a case. A couple of these cases made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Thurgood Marshall came down and argued this. It was on the front page of every newspaper. And there's no real mention of it or acknowledgement that this really happened in Lake County. I find that kind of striking because around the rest of the South, you're seeing monuments, memorials, museums, the legacy of lynching and atrocities. And there's really still nothing in Florida.
Gilbert King, what's your next project?
That's a really good question. I am looking at a couple ideas that I'm hoping can be long form, like book length projects. But in order to find out if it's a book length project, I have to probably do 6 months of research to make sure I have the right sources and to make sure that I'll have enough research to make a really longer narrative. Mm-hmm. So it's really, I don't really know, but I'm looking forward to getting back to that research and seeing if there's a book in there.
I mean, the way this book came about, you said, was because you were doing a reading and one of the people who turns out to be a central figure in this book, Beneath the Ruthless Sun, came up to you and said, there's more to tell. Have you had that experience at readings on this book tour as well?
I have that all the time. And 99% of the time, I can tell you that it's just not something that is going to sustain itself over a book narrative. It's an interesting story, but I think if the best of them are magazine articles that I've heard. To come up with a book idea, especially have somebody tell you this is your next idea, I mean, I was suspicious for months. And as I kept filing Freedom of Information Act requests, everything he was telling me was being backed up by the record. And I remember at one point I was thinking about maybe an article for this. And I remember sort of hitting the pay dirt where I just found these records and these smoking guns and it was all there. And I was like, this is a book. And it was never more apparent to me than, you know, after months of research on it, that this was going to be a real book. So hopefully I'll get that lucky again.
Gilbert King, author of Beneath the Ruthless Sun, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me, Matthew. Appreciate it.
And that interview first aired on Intersection last May. Still to come, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was the leading point scorer for the NBA when he retired from basketball in 1989. Since then, he's been a writer and advocate for social justice issues. Jabbar sees parallels between the student activists of today and the generation he grew up with. We're back with that conversation in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to revisit a conversation with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar played 20 seasons for the NBA with the Milwaukee Bucks and the LA Lakers. He's a six-time NBA champion and six-time MVP, and he's still the NBA's leading point scorer. He was appointed to President Obama's Council on Sports and Fitness, and in 2016 he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Abdul-Jabbar's written a dozen books, including Coach, Wooden and Me, and Writings on the Wall, Searching for a New Equality Beyond Black and White. And he chairs the Skyhook Foundation, which aims to bring STEM education opportunities to underserved children. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, thank you so much for joining me.
Glad to talk to you.
We are going to talk basketball. It's March after all. But first, I want to talk to you about gun violence, because you have a second chapter after your basketball career doing advocacy work. And I wanted to ask you about the debate over gun control right now. You know, back in 2015, you wrote in a piece in Time magazine, quote, "I am as much a part of the American gun culture as many other Americans, but even I know that something's got to change when it comes to guns in America, because what we're doing right now, which is a whole lot of nothing, isn't working," end quote. So I'm wondering what you make of the student-led protests that we're seeing in the wake of the school shooting in Parkland.
Well, I think it's the very obvious... Transformation of another generation of young Americans who have seen too much violence, and I think it's a direct result of that. And I'm glad to see that their reaction has been what it is. We can't tolerate this situation perpetuating itself forever.
Do you see some parallels with the generation you grew up in as far as activism goes?
Yes, I do. You know, the whole thing I think has to do with motivation. The things that have happened to them that motivate them really have created a whole new consciousness. You know, the young people in our country really see that nothing has been done for decades, and we need to address this issue.
So those student activists, what's your advice to them moving forward and as the months move on and the shooting recedes into the background?
Well, I think they have to, you know, understand that it has to be a long-term plan, because there's a lot of intransigence and indifference that they're trying to overcome. That's the worst, you know, people who aren't involved or people who don't care. So, you know, I think they have definitely taken on a big issue, and it's going to be a big problem, but they seem to be up for it.
An article in the New York Times focused on students at the march in Washington, D.C. last weekend and interviewed some students who were there to draw attention to a different kind of gun violence than the mass shooting which sparked that protest. And the newspaper quoted a student at the Friends School of Baltimore saying, quote, "It shouldn't take a mass shooting in a predominantly white area like Parkland to start caring about gun violence." Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, do you think that's the reason that there's more attention now being focused on this issue?
Well, I think what's happening is people are starting to see it as all part of the same issue. You know, the issue for gun violence in the black communities in America is part of the overall issue of gun violence in our country. It's just another segment of it. But now people are starting to see it all as one whole, and we have to get a grasp on it. We have to understand how pervasive and extensive it is and do something that can change what has been a very bad problem for a very long time.
Laura Ingraham on her Fox News show last year, she told LeBron James, quote, "Keep the political commentary to yourself," or as someone once said, "Shut up and dribble." I mean, what do you say to people who think politics has no place in sports?
Well, you know, the fact that I have a job as a professional athlete does not mean that I'm not supposed to be affected by some of the things that disturb me in American society. You know, LeBron James has every right to speak out on issues that happen in his community. I think he does a very noble and necessary job of motivating people to comment and or demonstrate when they feel that that is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my hat's off to him.
And I guess, you know, the NBA, the players, the owners, they have a platform, they can reach a lot of people. How much of an impact do you think they have on policy, on the kind of issues that they might be speaking out on?
Who knows, you know, how much. I think a lot of that has happened in places where, you know, I don't have access. But I think that the NBA has done a good job of representing the will of the players. That has been one of the strengths of the NBA.
Well, let me ask then about the NCAA. College sports are worth billions of dollars, but the student athletes are amateurs. They can't make money. Now, you wrote in an article for Jacobin magazine back in 2014 about the need to pay college athletes, and you talked about your own struggles to pay the bills when you played for UCLA. How likely do you think it is that the NCAA will change those rules and allow athletes to get paid, or at least change some of the rules around the way scholarships are administered?
I don't have much access to know what's going on right now, but it doesn't seem like there's been any real substantive movement toward change. So, you know, I don't think that the idea of paying the athletes has caught on in a way that would, you know, kindle a movement. Not yet, anyway.
Well, let me ask finally then about your Skyhook Foundation. It strives to bring STEM education opportunities to kids in underserved communities. NPR reported that there's a 5-year waiting list for the week-long STEM camps that the foundation runs, Camp Skyhook and the Los Angeles Unified School District. What does that tell you about the appetite for science and STEM education in those communities and the need for it?
Well, you know, I'm really encouraged that we have such a long waiting list. It shows that there's a thirst for these types of programs. I hope that we can get more funding so that we can make it more accessible to more kids in the LA Unified School District, because turning kids on to the various possibilities in their future really emboldens them and gives them a better idea of what they can do, you know, with their lives. So, you know, we hope that we continue to get the support of the various people who are kind enough to donate.
Well, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's nice talking to you.
And that interview first aired on Intersection last March. Still to come, a performance from Orlando blues legend Eugene Snowden. Intersection's back in a minute.
You are my car and your minery.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Eugene Snowden is a legend in the Orlando music scene. He built a reputation with his band, the legendary JCs, and more recently as a solo artist. Snowden and guitarist Justin Kangaga joined us in the studio for a performance last March.
The first song I'm going to play is a song that is called How Far I'm Canaan. Now, you may have heard of it recorded by Soul Stirrers, and before that, the Blind Boys Alabama. Before that, the Grand Harmonize in the 20s, but it's an old spiritual song. And my grandmother, Cora Bell Harrington, that's her name, Cora Bell, from Bethel, North Carolina, they would sing this song, and a lot of people sing this song. It's an old spiritual that came from way many years ago. And so you might hear versions of it, but it just reminded me of my grandma taking me to church, mm-hmm. which was our first university, really, in the neighborhood. So it's called How Far I'm From Canaan. I was standing on the Jordan, gazing across the stormy tide. And I saw the weeping of the troubled, and now waiting for time I can revive. I can hear the angels singing. I can see them across stormy tide. There I'll rest, I'll rest, I'll rest my weary head down, until all doubt and fear subside. As I traveled, oh, traveled on my journey, oh yeah, I faced many trials along the way, but now I have a blessed, blessed assurance that redemption will find me one day. I can hear the angels singing. I can feel them across the stormy tide. They all rest. I will rest my weary head and fear subside. Oh yeah.
I like that. It's my grandma. Yeah.
So where did you learn to play and to sing, Eugene?
Well, I come from a musical family, and my dad was a drummer. Jazz drummer. He played jazz with Dexter Gordon a lot in Europe, and he, when at a time when I was in the late 50s and jazz had come around, and he was one of the guys in Europe. He was in the army at the time, so he played in Europe. Dexter Gordon, Ahmad Jamal, different jazz people in Europe. My mom was a gospel singer, a group called the Four Freshmen. There was a popular group called the Four Freshmen, but she was a gospel group called the Four Freshmen, singing group. And then both of my grandfathers, my paternal and maternal grandfather, they both were. One was a blues player from North Carolina, my maternal one. And my paternal grandfather was a jazz player, like, Cap Calloway kind of jazz player. Both played guitar. Mm-hmm. So my dad taught us all drums. Our four brothers taught us all drums, all percussion. So I got the singing.
That's a lot of drumming in the family.
That's a lot of drumming. But he said, all my sons are going to learn drums. That's all it's supposed to do. And of course, my grandmothers and grandfathers also sang too. But guitar I just took up a little while ago. I haven't been a guitar player.
Yeah, when you say a little while ago, how long are we talking?
Well, a couple of years ago, I started playing because the band having the legendary JCs, the band I tour with, they stopped touring. So I was like, okay, I always played a little guitar, so I had to teach myself the guitar. And I immediately went to the blues and my grandfather because I could learn that a little better. And historically, I'm falling right in the line of my family when I do that stuff. So, and I started a night, Will at Will's Pub gave me a night on Wednesday. It's called 10 Pints of Truth. And it basically was me teaching myself guitar that whole time. Mm-hmm. So it's been a few years now, and it's gotten popular. And so that's how, in order for you to play solo, I had to start playing guitar again, so I'd accompany myself. So.
And so the audience kind of came along with you on the journey of learning your way around the guitar.
Yes, they did. They saw all my saw all the mistakes, all the quirks and everything, and I just worked them through. Mm-hmm. Working through live, which you shouldn't do, but if you do that, in my experience, if you do that, all the kinks are out already. You're all out front, baby. There's no way that you can sit in your house and shed, as they say, for a while, for months and months. You have to play for a month, play a few songs, and go out in front of the audience immediately. You got to get it or don't get it, man. You got to be on it. Mm-hmm. And that helps you with the nerves. Now, a lot of guys can't do that. A lot of people can't do that. But for me, that's what got all the nerves got out the way. Mm-hmm. And I got really comfortable.
So you grew up going to church. Is that the sort of musical tradition that you were exposed to from the very, very start?
Absolutely. That's where most of the people, the poor whites and poor blacks, the churches were all universities. It's where you learned everything. You learned how to play music. Everybody played by ear. And that's what amazes me sometimes about when you have a friend of mine who's a guitar professor at Rollins. He amazes him. He says, like, they're learning to play all this blues and all this roots music at colleges, but they're learning from people, poor white and poor black people, who are illiterate, didn't know how to read, but you learn there's a technique you have to study in school to learn this old traditional music, which is like, he thinks it's ridiculous, even though he teaches it there. And so that was what we came from. Mm-hmm. We came from all that, and that was our university where we taught church, where we taught us in church, and all kinds of things they taught us in church. It was crazy.
So tell me about the next song you all are going to play.
The next song is wrote by legendary JCs, my band, and for years, and it's called Memphis, and it's a song that we played with B.B. King, and he gave my record before I played, and he said, I like that JCs, and I like the song Memphis. So it's a song that B.B. King liked. 2, 3. Thank you.
your minority. Keep giving me hope, giving me hoping each and every season.
I think I got something in there anyway.
Yeah, you know, I got a little something.
You've sort of established a residency, I guess, in Orlando. Just tell me about how your the place you play, your kind of relationship with that pub and you know Will's pub and how you've kind of gotten established there as a recurring artist.
Oh yeah, well, I think I mentioned earlier about my about when the band of JC stopped touring in 2013 and started playing 13 or 14, yeah, 2013. And I taught myself guitar, started teaching. And so I went to Will and I said, hey, let me do a night there, you know. He said, yeah, do a night. And then it was in July of 2013. Then when it came around, I wanted to do it again. I want to have a residency where I can, you know, work the kinks out of what I do. And Will offered up Little Indies, a place that had just been opened next to Will's pub. And they said, what do you want to name it? I said, name it 10 Pints of Truth, because at the time it didn't have liquor there. This was beer. So I said, 10 Pints of Truth. And it was a night that I wanted to dedicate to not only help get my chops back so I can become a solo artist myself. It was a night where I wanted to keep up the grand tradition of residencies, first of all, and also do the way the music used to be. Rock and roll and all those things had to be invented first. And this was the nights like the Chitlin' Circuit and the Honky Tonks and all those places. This is where how the music was played. Loud, crazy, kind of dirty and risque, but that's the way where rock and roll was built. It wasn't built in all the other things. Before the music went to the cities and reached its apotheosis in Chicago and New York, where it started in the South in joints like this, and the Honky Tonks and juke joints and Chitlin' Circuit clubs. Mm-hmm. And I want to bring that back.
So tell me about the next song you're going to play.
The next song, matter of fact, I say I'm going to play the song Lifting Me. Lifting Me, this is a song I changed up a little bit. This is a song that is it's a funk song, but... played by the JCs, but I'm going to do it style of my grandfather, because I always said whatever I do, I'm going to pay homage to my grandparents. So this is a song called Lifting Me.
Give me a little leading like that, brother. Oh, well. Well, I walk these empty streets, thinking about the time I've been planted seed. Things have changed beyond my repair. I don't believe in what I see, and everything I feel is so unreal. I was sinking within, seeing the leaves gonna rise, but I heard a call from above. I say, my. I was sinking deep within, thinking too deep could rise. Somebody heard my cry, saving my, cause the light has lifted me up. The light has lifted me up, light has lifted me up. Light has lifted me, lifted me up.
Eugene Snowden and Justin Kangaga, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me, man. If you want to talk some more about some other stuff, I'll be around.
It's been a long, hard road from where...
That performance first aired on Intersection in March. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. You can find us on the NPR One app. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.
And the wounds from our troubles cut so deep, we know we should have parted. By using all that we've got to hold on.